army sent my daddy home with shrapnel in his hands. Uncle got him working at the plant. He said he felt like he was back behind a prison wall. Ma said it was a shame he came home at all. Left us rosaries and magazines and cards. She prayed as I played in the yard. Daddy left his work boots in the dumpster up the street. The foreman said, take all the time you need. He took up carving figures with a rusty pocket knife. His broken hand brought the wood to life. He whispered and he hummed while he whittled with his thumbs and told me fairy tales that he made up. He talked about the desert and a soldier on a quest, and he twitched as he described the sun's relentlessness. He pulled the window curtains down and next he took the blinds. I wonder if he thought the sun might need his help to shine.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Kenny?
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, search corporate news media for recent stories on the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. in which some of the city's overwhelmingly black residents were paying upwards of $300 a month for water they couldn't even drink, based on an infrastructure decision on the water's source that their elected officials had no say in. And you'll find a few reports on how, yes, lead leaching pipes endangered people's health, but there's been a multi-million dollar settlement and a presidential commitment to address lead in water, so maybe it's all over but the shouting. CNN hosted a Republican Michigan Congress member who explained that Flint was under an unelected, austerity-minded emergency manager because, quote, their city had essentially collapsed. They had no strong functioning government, and the state had to step in, and there was an error in shifting water sources, close quote. That sounds lamentable, but not really blameworthy. So how do you square that sorry, but let's move forward line with the information that investigators looking into the crisis found that the cell phones of key health officials and other players like then Governor Rick Snyder's press secretary had been wiped of messages for the key period? While corporate media have largely let Flint go, the story isn't over, nor has justice been served. We'll hear from a reporter still on the case, Jordan Sheraton from independent news network Status Quo News. Also on the show, you don't need to put your ear to the ground to hear U.S. news media drumbeats for war of some sort with official enemies China and or Russia. With China, part of what we're being told to two-minute hate is their involvement on the African continent, where we're to understand they are nefariously trapping countries in debt, unlike the U.S. involvement in the region, which has been about bringing joy and love and hope. Just because a playbook is old doesn't mean it won't be used again and again. That vision relies on amnesia and ignorance of what the U.S. has done and is doing in sub-Saharan Africa, a topic that, if news media wanted to explore it, well, they had a great chance this past week with the 60th anniversary of the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the first elected prime minister of Democratic Republic of the Congo. Why was Lumumba killed? And what is the living legacy of that undercovered murder? We'll hear from Maurice Carney, co-founder and executive director of the group Friends of the Congo. That's coming up this week on Counterspin, brought to you every week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. In an op-ed for The Hill a year ago, Michigan Representative Dan Kildee called the 2014 decision to switch the source of Flint, Michigan's drinking water, quote, one of the greatest environmental injustices in our lifetimes, close quote. That may be true, but the environment didn't do it. The Flint crisis was and is a crisis of democracy. Decision-making had been taken out of the hands of Flint's elected officials and given to an emergency manager tasked with reining in costs, a process that seems to be used disproportionately in communities of color, taking decisions out of community hands but leaving them to deal with their fallout. The Flint story reflects malfeasance, austerity politics, and punishing indifference to the lives of black and brown people, as well as the limits of news media's attention span. Evidence suggests most big media have either swallowed the Pollyanna line that the Flint water crisis is over and justice served, or else the nihilist line that Flint was really no worse than lots of other places, so what are you going to do? But some journalists have not stopped seeing the ongoing community harms resulting from decisions carried out by real people with names and addresses as worthy of pursuit. We're joined now by Jordan Sheraton, investigative reporter and the CEO of independent news network Status Quo News. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Jordan Sheraton.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, the story has some twists and turns and a lot of players, individual and institutional. Folks can listen to previous interviews to get some of the early issues, but I'd like to ask you to bring us up to date. What are the latest developments in efforts to hold officials accountable for what was not an accident, but a crime, and one with real and ongoing effects?
Yeah, so unfortunately, the latest efforts seem to be inadequate based on my reporting. But the current Attorney General of Michigan, Dana Nessel, and her prosecution team, which basically is the second Flint investigation in 8 years. There was an original investigation team launched under the previous Michigan Attorney General. They investigated from 2016 through 2018. And then when the current Attorney General, Nessel, came in, she basically fired that team and restarted the whole investigation. That new investigation charged Governor Snyder last year with a misdemeanor for his role in the water crisis. My reporting over the years has indicated there was a whole lot more there than a misdemeanor. And my reporting actually showed that the original Flint water investigators who were fired by the current attorney general, they were actually building a case against the governor for involuntary manslaughter. So they were going much more aggressively against the governor than the current prosecution team ended up doing. They only charged him with a misdemeanor. There has been some other charges against state and city officials. Nothing has gone to trial yet. Currently, the governor, former Governor Rick Snyder, and other defendants are trying to get the charges tossed, basically claiming that the prosecution team made errors in how they collected and distributed evidence. So right now, it's kind of stuck in delays. And, you know, big picture, we're now heading into year 8 in April. No one has been convicted. No one is in jail. The people of Flint are still suffering. Residents are getting sicker and sicker as the years go on. I think that's something people don't realize, the effects of heavy metal poisoning. It gets worse as the years goes on. So residents I speak with developing cancers that they had no family history for, liver issues, kidney issues, bone issues, autoimmune issues, and of course the children, learning disabilities, behavioral problems, you know, all sorts of things. So it's still very much a crisis. And, you know, in my view, the media has totally abandoned this and abdicated their responsibility to cover it and treat it as an ongoing crisis.
Well, yeah, let me just start from there, because it seems to me that media didn't just stop covering Flint. They kind of declared it over. You know, they kind of said, it's fixed. You've been working with Detroit Metro Times, with The Intercept, and since the start, it seems like local media have done more and done better and done deeper than big media. But in big national media, it's almost not like it's over. It's like, oh, no, it worked out, you know, and that couldn't be more wrong, you're saying.
Yeah, if I write a book one day, the media will be a big part of it, because honestly, they're as complicit in the cover-up as the politicians at this point. Actually, if I roll back to 2018, you know, the media at that point was just basically regurgitating the data that then Governor Snyder and his team were putting out there, data that showed the lead levels were dramatically falling and that the levels were now, quote-unquote, you know, meeting EPA regulations. But I was hearing from residents and sources that they basically manipulated the testing and the data. So I did something radical these days for a journalist, and I went to Flint, and I just started knocking on doors. Mm-hmm. And myself, and at the time, my previous reporting partner, we knocked on nearly 500 doors in the summer and fall of 2018. And what we discovered was that the state of Michigan Environmental Department was literally running residents' water right before taking lead and copper samples. Like just a few minutes before taking the sample, they were running water, which is against EPA regulations. So voila, they were getting low lead levels because they were basically flushing away potential lead. I was actually working on that story for Newsweek, trying to get it in a bigger national outlet with the hope of it getting, you know, getting traction. Newsweek literally killed the story the week it was supposed to be published, claiming we didn't have enough data, even though we had dozens and dozens of examples on the record, residents on the record, that state officials had run their water before testing or told them to run their water before testing. So we ended up self-publishing it. But even in 2018, it was very clear that the way they were testing was completely wrong and borderline just cooking the data. So when you see stories from Reuters and elsewhere that 3,000 other cities have higher lead levels than Flint, I was screaming, well, we don't really know what the real lead levels are in Flint because there was no integrity in the testing. Aaron Brockovich actually, when our story came out, said, this is a crime. It's falsifying lead and copper samples. That's a crime, and the testing should be tossed out. So since then, the testing has still been inadequate. They're not even testing as many homes as they should be in Flint, and they haven't even changed all of the busted pipes. So how could you say the water's safe if 8 years later they haven't even replaced all the pipes? They haven't touched the pipes inside their home, which were already damaged. So this is your classic example of, you know, the media got caught up in kind of the five-year Trump circus. A lot of other stories fell through the cracks, and the media, national and local, just basically regurgitated falsified data that was being fed to them by the very state government that presided over the poisoning. And to tell you the truth, the current Democratic governor, Gretchen Whitmer, and the current Democratic attorney general haven't really done much better. There's really been this push to declare it over, to claim that it's not an issue with the water anymore. The water's fine. Now it's just about rebuilding trust. Well, I was just in Flint over the summer. I could tell you, I spoke with residents who showed me rashes they are still getting from that water, hair loss. They're still losing hair when they shower. Residents describing their eyes burning in the shower. Anecdotally, I have sat in homes within the last year where the water stinks. So, you know, it's very easy for media in New York, D.C., on the West Coast to basically regurgitate what they're fed by the government. But it's a lot harder and more expensive, by the way, to actually go there and with your own eyes and talk to residents to find out, yeah, this is more of a narrative. This isn't actually reality that it's solved.
Well, let me just say, finally, maybe I know the answer. President Biden said just recently, I want you to know I see you, I hear you, we understand, and I've seen and we've understood the damage done in places like Flint, Michigan, and Jackson, Mississippi. So we've already announced over $7 billion in clean water funding to states so they can fix and upgrade their aging water systems and sewer systems. What's your response to that kind of official declaration vis-a-vis human beings in Flint, Michigan?
Well, first of all, it's a nice slogan to say the infrastructure deal is going to deliver clean water and replace all pipes. The actual money earmarked to replace lead pipes is not enough to replace all lead pipes in the country. So that's number one. Number two, there's a misnomer that the only issue with water is lead. That's not the only issue contaminating our water. There's a lot of other contaminants in our water.
Right.
And a lot of those contaminants are coming from corporate and industrial pollution. So this was more of a marketing slogan and a messaging thing by Biden and the Democrats, not to say replacing some lead lines is, of course, better than nothing, but that's not going to completely fix the problem. And when you look at Flint specifically, why is it that Flint, Michigan, majority black, those residents don't have Medicare for All for being poisoned by their government? But when you look up to Libby, Montana, those residents, 96% white, they have universal health care because of an asbestos disaster that happened over a decade there where a lot of people died. They got universal health care in Libby, Montana. Your listeners should look that up. People of Flint, they don't have universal health care. They got a short-term expansion of Medicaid, and that's pretty much over now. I talked to residents who are nearly going bankrupt because of the bills they have for environmental doctors, because for heavy metal poisoning, a normal internist is not enough. You really need specific, specialized doctors. So the people of Flint, there's been a lot of woke language, and we hear you, and you know we're going to do everything for you. But if you talk to the people of Flint, they are still screaming for help. And real quickly, this is also a major problem with local media. I've broken at least four pretty significant stories on the Flint water cover-up over the last 2 years. The Flint Journal has not covered any of it. The Detroit Free Press has not covered any of it. The Detroit News has not covered any of it. And I literally have spoken with people from those outlets who have told me point blank, yeah, there's pressure from the top just to kind of not cover that anymore. So I have no idea why, but this is a national media failure, but it's also a local media failure because the local media in Michigan has essentially continued this narrative that the water is fine now, and that this is now, you know, let's move on.
We've been speaking with Jordan Cheriton, reporter and CEO at the independent news network Status Quo News. Thank you so much, Jordan Cheriton, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
We saw a good amount of media attention to Reverend Martin Luther King this past week, including, yes, the FBI pretending with a straight face that they are honoring his legacy, but also some acknowledgement of a point that we at FAIR make, that celebration of King today is often a whitewashing, avoiding discussion of many of his actual views, and that the news media, who are so full of bromides for King and his death, were working hard attacking and undermining him while he lived. Meanwhile, another anniversary that offered opportunity for reflection was utterly overlooked. January 17th marked 60 years since the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the first elected prime minister of the post-independence Democratic Republic of the Congo, a crime in which the U.S. played a significant role. In August of 1960, CIA Director Alan Dulles told the agency's station in Congo that it is the clear-cut conclusion that if Lumumba continues to hold high office, the inevitable result will at best be chaos and at worst pave the way to communist takeover of the Congo, with disastrous consequences for the prestige of UN and for the interests of the free world generally. Consequently, we conclude that his removal must be an urgent and prime objective. As corporate media bang the drums for a new or continued Cold War in Africa today, the story of Lumumba seems especially significant. But telling it openly would require a dry-eyed examination of U.S. actions and intentions that corporate news media are just not in the business of providing. We're joined now by Maurice Carney, co-founder and executive director of the group Friends of the Congo. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Maurice Carney.
It's a pleasure to be back with you, Jane.
Well, may I just ask you to talk a bit about January 1961 and the context for the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. The country is newly independent, but still in transition. Why was Lumumba considered such a danger?
Lumumba was considered a danger for several reasons. One, he was a nationalist and a Pan-Africanist. And as he articulated in his June 30th, 1960 inaugural speech, that he wanted the resources of the Congo to benefit the Congolese people. Anyone familiar with the creation of the Congo was created by European nations. It was created as an outpost for the extraction of natural resources to benefit Europe and the West. And Lumumba represented an end to that system. So that's one reason. Secondly, he was uncompromising in his critique of the colonial history in the Congo and really contemporary imperialism. And he was an anti-colonial fighter. So that also represented a problem. And so those two reasons, the critique that he brought against colonialism and imperialism, the uncompromising self-sufficiency, self-determination, and Pan-Africanism that he articulated indicated that he was someone that couldn't necessarily be controlled or owned or readily influenced by the West. So that posed a huge problem for the United States and European powers as well.
Well, I think the failure to even talk about the assassination today reflects in some ways just how important and how dangerous Lumumba was judged, so much so that we can't even explore it now. But his murder was important and inspired action.
Yeah, in fact, Professor Georges Nzengola Ntalaja argues that the assassination of Patrice Lumumba is one of the most important assassinations of the 20th century. Professor Nzengola is now ambassador to the United Nations of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. He had written a book entitled Lumumba. So he articulated just the significance of Lumumba's assassination. In fact, even the chief of station of the CIA in the Congo, Larry Devlin, in a book with the same title, Chief of Station Congo, laid out how critical Lumumba was not only to the Congo, Janine, but to Africa at large. That is to say, Devlin shared and he intimated that we had to get rid of Lumumba because not only would we have lost the Congo, Lumumba would to stay and remain in power, but we would have lost all of Africa. So we see the centrality of Lumumba to not only post-independence Congo, but a post-independence Africa. And the president of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah, articulated that and concurred with that. Because in his book, The Challenge of the Congo, he shared how Congo would ultimately serve as the capital of Nkrumah's project, of the Pan-African project of the United States of Africa. So Congo, which is located in the heart of the African continent, arguably one of the richest countries on the planet in terms of natural resources, strategically located on the African continent, was vital to Nkrumah's Pan-African project. So it was a very critical country, and Lumumba was a Pan-Africanist who accepted and acknowledged the role that Congo would play in a self-determined, independent Africa.
Well, you and I talked at one point about how U.S. officials were saying, and this is just a few years ago, U.S. officials were saying and media were parroting the statement, Congo hasn't had a peaceful transfer of power since 1960, you know, without even pretending to explore why that is and what the U.S. role has been in that. And I just wonder if you could address the role of news media here in, I mean, it's mainly what they haven't done with regard to this, or what they have done. I don't know. Yeah.
And I think when we had this discussion, it was around the role that, if I'm not mistaken, I think it may have been Time magazine had played at the time in planting stories that were fed to them by the Central Intelligence Agency, in presenting Lumumba in a disparaging fashion, basically working hand in glove with U.S. foreign policy in destabilizing the Congo. So the media was, through its vocal means and at the time of Lumumba, they did play a destructive role, and today through its silence. We know, based on U.S. documents that were recently published, declassified documents that were recently published by the U.S. State Department, that the United States played a critical role in the destabilizing of the Congo, not only during the time of Lumumba, but right up until today. Declassified documents from the State Department say that at a time, the covert action in the Congo was the largest in the world by the United States government, and that for the first 10 years or so of Congo's independence, the Central Intelligence Agency had a role to play in who would lead the Congo. As you know, it went through several leaders. And, of course, the leader that wound up taking control of the country, Joseph Désiré Mobutu in 1965, was installed, backed, and maintained by the United States. So to the extent that we see instability in the Congo, that we see corruption, that we see a lack of security, the role the United States played in uprooting the nascent democratic process that began in that country with the election of Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba, that role by the United States is central. And it's something that, unfortunately, today's media has not taken up and articulated and shared with the American public in the way that it ought to or that it should.
Well, finally, right now, Patrice Lumumba's family is fighting for the return of his remains, such as they are. Listeners may not know his body was dissolved in sulfuric acid. But the demands go beyond that important repatriation. If we heard the voice of the Congolese people, not just Lumumba's family, but if we could hear the voice of Congolese people today, what would they be saying that we're not hearing?
Well, we, Friends of the Congo, honored the daughter of Lumumba during a Congo Week event, Juliana Lumumba, who has led the fight to have her father's remains repatriated to the country. And in her acknowledgement speech, she had a message for the Congolese youth. That is to continue the teachings, the ideas of Lumumba, to look at him as a model and example of sacrificing his life for a country and a continent. And Congolese youth today embrace that sentiment, particularly through their music. There are a number of Congolese musicians, hip-hop artists, who bring Lumumba's ideas and teachings to the current generation of Congolese. So they are actually embracing Lumumba's ideas, embracing Lumumba's teachings, the ideas of self-sufficiency, self-determination, Pan-Africanism. The Congolese youth have taken that up today, and they are sharing it with their current generation, and they're doing it through music, through art, through writing. So he is, especially in light, Janine, of the lack of strong leadership, not only in the Congo, but throughout the African continent, Lumumba is being fully embraced, fully shared, and being held up as a model for future leaders. So he's in good stead. And we acknowledge Lumumba ourselves through a campaign that's on Lumumba Day, lumumbaday.org, lumumbaday.org, where people throughout the world are joining up and saying they're going, even if the media doesn't speak about it, about Lumumba and his importance and significance, they're going to do so. And they're doing that from the platform of lumumbaday.org. Every January 17th, he's being held up, along with the colleagues who were assassinated with him, Maurice Mpolo and Joseph Okito. So his legacy is in very, very good standing with not only Congolese youth, but people throughout the globe.
We've been speaking with Maurice Carney, co-founder and executive director of the group Friends of the Congo. You can find them online at friendsofthecongo.org. Maurice Carney, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine. It's been my pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Ah, what's happening? Excuse me, who am I? Hello? Why am I here? What's my purpose in life? What do I mean by who am I?
Oh, calm down. Get a grip now. Oh, this is an interesting sensation.
What is it? It's a sort of yawning, tingling sensation in my... Well, I suppose I better start finding names for things if I want to make any headway in what, for the sake of what I shall call an argument, I shall call the world. So, let's call it my stomach. So, a yawning, tingling sensation in my stomach. Good. Ooh, it's getting quite strong. And hey, what about this whistling, roaring sound going past what I'm suddenly going to call my head? That can be wind. Is that a good name? Well, it'll do. Perhaps I can find a better name for it later when I find out what it's for, because there certainly seems to be a hell of a lot of it. Hey, what's this thing? This, let's call it, tail. Yeah, tail. Hey, I can really thrash it out pretty good, can't I? Wow! Wow! Hey! Doesn't seem to achieve much, but I'll probably find out what it's for later on. Now, have I built up any coherent picture of things yet? No. Oh, well, hey, this is really exciting. So much to find out about, so much to look forward to. I'm quite dizzy with anticipation. Or is it the wind? Hey, there really is a bug of that now, isn't there? And wow, what's this thing coming towards me very fast? Very, very fast. So big and flat and wide. It needs a big, wide sounding sort of word like round. Ground! That's it. Ground! I wonder if it'll be friends with me.
WRCT, Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
This is Depose from The Faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey, look how cheap this one is.
That's a counterfeit.
So what?
So what? Your skin lotion could have something scary in it, like antifreeze or other poisons. It could even be urine and mouse droppings you're rubbing all over your skin, and you wouldn't even know it.
No way. That's creepy and sick.
Yeah, that's why we need to know what's inside.
To find out more about how counterfeits can cause real harm to you and your family, visit ncpc.org/goforreal. Brought to you by the National Crime Prevention Council and the United States Patent and Trademark Office.
You are listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh. It's the Mockster. Normally at this time, you're tuning in to hear an encore presentation of the Viva La Mock radio program. But last weekend was Massive Music Weekend here on WRCT, which means there was no Viva La Mock. So instead, how about an encore presentation of some of the artists I featured during Massive Music Weekend, starting things off with 30 minutes of Chicago's own Material Issue.
Valerie's dancing on the room above my bed, you know. Follow the world below to see. Valerie's leaving on a car outside my house, you know. Such a shame she's not with me. And all the pretty things, and all the love my heart could bring, I would give my whole life to her. Valerie loves me. Valerie's riding in a car around my neighborhood. She's thinking of all the men she'll meet. I could only hope for a stolen moment of her thoughts between the walk, the club, and all the drinks she'll have.
Formed in 1985 by singer Jim Ellison, the power pop trio self-released an EP in 1987.
Yeah.
1991 saw the release of their full-length debut, International Pop Overthrow, an album that was produced by Jeff Murphy of The Shoes. The first single that came off of 1991's International Pop Overthrow album, Diane, here on 88.3 FM. Before that, from their self-released 1987 EP that was Material Issue with She's Going Through My Head. And start off the entire show with another track off that International Pop Overthrow album, And Valerie Loves Me. And speaking of the International Pop Overthrow album, why not play the title track?
International Pop.
In 1992, Material Issue followed up their breakthrough debut with Destination Universe, and once again produced by Jeff Murphy. Material Issue's third and final proper release, Freak City Soundtrack, came out in 1994. It was produced by legendary producer Mark Chapman, who was known for his work with The Sweet, Suzy Quatro, and producing the breakthrough albums by Blondie and The Knack. The album also featured guests like Rick Nielsen of Cheap Trick and Gilby Clark of Guns N' Roses. Sales, however, were disappointing, and by early 1995, the band parted ways with Mercury Records.
Well, I know it's been a little while since the first time that I made you smile. I thought I'd take this opportunity to dig a little deeper inside and try to find out what someone like you is trying to hide from me. Well, I hope that you don't get angry, girl, and I hope that you don't get hurt by the things I've found while going through your things. Your makeup and your compact and your lipstick like that and the keys that you keep on a chain. Your cigarettes and my lighter too and a picture of your sister. God, I think you're one of the same. And I cleverly put all these things back into place so you wouldn't think that I was a jerk. Yeah, the things I found while going through your face.
Sadly, on June 20th, 1996, Jim Ellison, the man who started the band 11 years before, committed suicide at the age of 32. Recordings done in 1995 and 1996 were released posthumously on a fourth and final album, Telecommando Americano.
Smiling faces, I don't wanna let you bring me down. What am I?
That has been 30 minutes of Material Issue. A feature-length documentary on the band is scheduled to be released later this year. Don't forget, you can listen to me Friday nights at 9 here on 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh in a little show I call Viva La Mock. I also want to remind you that Spack Brothers Pizza joins you in supporting WRCT Pittsburgh. Spack Brothers Pizza offers pizza, hoagies, and wings while they specialize in vegan and vegetarian alternatives. Spack Brothers Pizza uses no refined sugars in their sauce or any unbleached flour in their dough. Spack Brothers is committed to safety during the ongoing pandemic by providing online ordering and payment as well as contact-free pickup. You can learn more about the online ordering at SpackBrothers.com. For more information, call 412-362-SPAK or visit their website at SpackBrothers.com. That's 412-362-SPAK. 7725 or spakbrothers.com. And don't forget, if you are ever interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email pr@wrct.org for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities.
Eric Harrison enjoying some whiskey before breakfast with Mando Richard. Wednesdays at 11 a.m. here at WRCT Pittsburgh. Drink up, Yinzers.
Everybody ready?
Hi everybody, and welcome to episode 2204 of Whiskey Before Breakfast on WRCT Pittsburgh, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark, Delaware, WUTC and WUTC HD1 Chattanooga, Tennessee, WKYWLP Kaiser, West Virginia, and Tube City Online Radio from McKees Court, Pennsylvania at WMCK.FM. I am Mando Richard, and even though I'm recovering from COVID-19, yes, your DJ got sick, I have got a wild show for you today. We'll start off on the Liquored Upset like we usually do, and we'll end up on the gospel side of the family like we usually do, and in between, we lots of good music. Let's get things underway quickly, shall we? Here comes the Nashville Bluegrass Band with the Gambling Barroom Blues, right here on Whiskey Before Breakfast.
doctor, "Look out, it's low," he said. I went back to see my baby. Good God, she was lying there dead. I strolled on back to the bar room, drinking whiskey till night. It hurt me so to see my gal lying there so cold, so never found a pal like me. 16 coal black horses all hitched up in a line. In that pretty buggy she's riding,